I just watched Shampoo again on the plane the other day, and I forgot the whole political backdrop to that film, and also just addressing the sort of disposable nature of relationships and women and the need to have money, which has never really left our culture, powerful men. God, it's just like there's just been so many great eras. And then once I kind of hit my stride post King of Comedy and started, you know, doing my one-woman shows and being in New York and just the energy of the club scene and the artists and all the great people that came out of the 80s and then the AIDS situation that decimated a whole culture and generation. So up until the AIDS crisis, to me, it was just like the most exciting time. And then it was a devastating time, and things really shifted after that, I think, in terms of the gay culture and the sort of openness and freedom that was such a great reflection of growing up in that era.
You're listening to The Big Interview with me, Tyler Brulé. My guest today is a performer, actress, activist, singer, and author, and my first interview from way back in the day when I was a Cub reporter. A pioneer of the one-woman show and a showbiz veteran, Sandra Bernhardt has a career that spans more than three decades and mediums as diverse as TV, film, Broadway, and radio, where she now hosts the hugely popular Sandyland, her daily show on Sirius XM. Her subjects range from the deeply personal to the political to the profane. And in discussing it all, Bernhardt brings to the stage a completely unique mix of stand-up, social commentary, and even a bit of cabaret. I'm pleased to say Sandra Bernhardt joined me in London before the opening night of her most recent gig, Sandemonium, for The Big Interview. We're not in our usual surrounds, which would be Studio One. We've made a very special visit to an old home of mine. We're at the Covent Garden Hotel, where we're welcoming a very special guest, Sandra Bernhardt. Hello.
Hi. When were you staying at the Covent Garden Hotel?
I was staying here. I lived here in maybe like 1998, something like that, in between homes and partners and all kinds of things. Now, I want to rewind. I was doing the math on the way in from Frankfurt this morning. I think the first time we met in a professional capacity was probably 25 years ago.
In Toronto, right?
Well, there's Toronto, but I think that was post. I'm thinking to a little house in the valley that you had.
Yeah, my house on Blicks.
And then we
went to... Between Kling and Klump, right around the corner from Hortense. Is that Hortense? No, she's always that way. My famous joke.
Do you have that... Is that joint been sold? You've sold out from the valley.
Yes, about 6 years ago I sold
And we
that.
Went for... I think we went for chicken salad at that really kind of great dinery joint around the corner down the...
Dupars.
Yes. Still with us or not?
No, I think Dupars is on its way out, sadly. That's really depressing. Dupars is a landmark in Los Angeles.
I want to come back to London and why you're here, but I think we should stay on the far side of the Atlantic for a moment. So you've traded off the West Coast. And I think the last time I saw you in semi-professional capacity, I bumped into you at Jeffrey.
The store that manages to hold on. I don't know. I never see anybody buying anything there, but I guess it's funded because people have deep pockets and they just keep, you know, making it the fashion mecca. But I don't know how any of those kind of stores stay in business anymore.
And we need to talk about retail as well today. But tell me the journey. Just update me.
I moved on a more permanent basis to New York because I had my daughter, who's 19 and a half. And then I met my girlfriend, my partner, Sarah, who worked at Vanity Fair for many years. And it was just easier to base our operations there. And we decided it would be a better setting for our daughter to go to school in New York than Los Angeles, which I think really paid off. She did very well in New York, and now she's in college. She goes to Middlebury College in Vermont, but it looks like she's going to spend her junior year here in London at Goldsmith College.
What's she doing?
She's majoring in film.
Not to make it about her, but
film
why not,
and
right?
Media studies and minoring in gender studies.
New York today, I mean, you were such a fixture on the West Coast for such a long time, but obviously career started very much in New York. But do you feel good being back in New York? I think perhaps given the tone, the platform that you have right now, better to be a little bit more at the center of it on the East Coast than on the West Coast?
It's easier to maneuver the city. You know, I mean, I spend a lot of time in LA. We go every few months for meetings, and I do my radio show, which I do on Sirius XM called Sandyland, every day, 12 to 1. which is a lot of fun, but it's harder to do from LA. People don't tend to want to do press in LA. It's weird because when they're in LA, they're living there. So it's like, yeah, I try to get people just to come in and be spontaneous, like old school, just to talk about life and fun things. And most people don't want to do that. They're either working or they just don't want to talk about their lives. And I understand that. So New York has the, you know, Sirius XM headquarters. So you just go in every day. I take the subway, which has really been fun. And, you know, you get to see life in a little different, you know, point of view.
How does radio feel? I mean, not this radio setup, but Sandyland in general.
Sandyland's fun. I mean, it's been a great incubator for me to work on material, not intentionally, but because you go in every day and I have to fill in, you know, a 15-minute kind of freewheeling monologue. And also, I've never really gotten to, you know, to talk to people from the other side of the microphone, which is, you know, I think I'm very good at it. And I like to keep conversations moving. And I always sort of did that inherently when I was on like Letterman and stuff. I'd always sort of turn the tables naturally because I'm interested to know what people are doing and what their lives are like. So it's not, I don't just like to talk about myself. I also like to bounce off of people and see what they're up to.
Is there a certain liberty with radio? Just no five cameras and everything
else
around you?
Yes, it's very relaxed. And I think when people come on the show, I try to steer away from whatever they're promoting and really talk about things that are unexpected and fun. Not in a, you know, sort of, you know, premeditated way, but really trying to be like genuine, authentic in the moment. And I think that people appreciate that now more than ever.
How do you get cut through? I mean, there's just so much out there right now, and I wanted to spend maybe, you know, a good chunk of this just talking about the state of media today. So when you're talking to producers, when you're riding the subway and you think about the program, you know, obviously it has to have, it's got a standard narrative to it. But what are you looking to achieve and deliver with the program?
A sense of the quotidian, a sense that, you know, people have gotten to know me, what I do every day, you know, getting up, doing my laundry, taking our dog George out for a walk, you know, what it's like to be in a long-term relationship, you know, frustrations with my daughter. I've sort of like, you know, switched it up. And of course, I still talk about, you know, Isaac Mizrahi comes on, or, you know, fashion people or music people. And I'm still very much plugged in. But I think it's just fun to talk about, you know, just the day-to-day stuff and people getting to know you. I think it's very comforting right now.
And do you think that's what people are, in a way, looking for, those pockets? Because, you know, if you think back 25 years ago, 15 years ago, there were fewer outlets. There may be more prominent outlets that everyone went to, whether it was the late night talk show circuit or was a specific program on NPR. I mean, you mentioned your partner, you know, being at Vanity Fair. Vanity Fair is still a strong brand, but not what it was.
It won't be soon. They just fired all the great people. It's terrible. I mean, a woman editor came in, took over from Graydon Carter, who was one of the all-time brilliant editors.
Because he was Canadian.
Anywhere, because he was Canadian. Yeah. Well, and he also, like, he had a life before he did this. Like, he worked on trains and, like, was, like, did manual labor. And then he started Spy magazine, which was brilliant and way ahead of the curve. Then this woman has come in and just, like chopped down the forest. And it's really depressing and upsetting. And, there's no way you can start from scratch when you've built up that ensemble of editors and, you know, publicists and people who knew it and loved it and had a passion for it. So anyway, that's a sidebar.
Yeah, but it's a big sidebar because it's, you know, good talent's expensive, isn't it?
Yes, and they don't want to pay good talent. That's the other problem.
And it's very easy to, you know, as we all know, paste links, call that media, move digital, do it on the cheap.
That's,
you know,
right.
Et cetera, and
yeah,
keep it going. And it's amazing how, yeah, as you said, great brand like Vanity Fair, but I think many others. So in a way, do you think sort of like the green shoots to the sidewalk become, as you said, you know, having this sort of quotidian program, you know, which is, yeah, about sort of looking at sort of, you know, the fun and foibles of daily life, obviously sort of very, very real, sort of like an audio column in a way.
Right,
That you've got with, of course, nice sprinkling of people coming in and
yes,
out.
Yes, yes.
But is
You'd
that...
You'd be surprised. People call me from South Carolina and Arkansas. And there's these two women who are truckers who like do long haul trucking, who are retiring soon. A lot of mothers and daughters listen to my show, which is totally surprising. Like, you know, daughters that are my daughter's age, and they come to my live shows now, and I'm so excited about that, because because of the nature of getting to know me day to day, people see a different side to me and an accessibility that I don't think they understood, or maybe they didn't even know where to find me before. Even bigger. I haven't come through Arkansas lately and performed, you know, but maybe now I will.
How much has the narrative had to change? I mean, I think back to probably the first interview I did was it for British Elle or was it the German magazine Tempo? Those amazing shots that Michelle Comte did of you, which
yes.
were incredible. I hope you've got the print somewhere.
Well, you know what? I'm endlessly frustrated with Michelle Comte. And we see each other every few years. Then he disappears. We have these huge...
Should we go find him now?
Yes.
Where is he right now?
Oversized conversations about how he's going to do a book based on all my photos. And then he says they're in, you know, archives in Zurich. I think he's in Switzerland now.
He's busy building a village right now for the mountains. That's where he is.
Well, I don't think so. But I'm totally frustrated because that book should have come out 10 years ago. But if anybody can track down Michelle Comte, it's you.
You looked great then. You look great now.
Thank you.
If I think
I'll look better tonight once I get my hair and makeup done.
But the narrative, I think back, you know, there was, you know, and obviously an edge. If I sort of think about the word risque, which, you know, has sort of fallen out of fashion.
Bring it back.
But can you bring it back? Because there's always a twit storm about something and, you know, you're going to get run down on the street for saying something. And so is the gig harder now?
That's why I've shifted gears. I've shifted gears into something that is less volatile because... the volatility now is so cheap, you know, with reality television and social media and everything so accessible, but yet nobody's emotions are accessible. It's just the superficial is accessible. So I've downshifted into a more emotional, but not maudlin, because that's just never going to be me, openness that I didn't have 20 years ago because I wasn't in the headspace, and now I'm in the headspace. So I go against all of that and try to, like, maintain the fun, the zhuzh, the joie de vivre, the excitement, but still underneath it expose more of, you know, the day-to-day of who I am.
Do we get to a point where we're all going to be exhausted by the rage? I mean, there's, of course...
There's plenty of
legitimate rage, but every time I look at websites that belong to responsible media organizations... you know, there are so many things which flare up for 5 minutes and then go away and are so distracting from some significant bigger stories in the world. But do you think, you know, we've seen enough cycles in our time. Do we move out of this? I mean, hear a lot of people say they don't want to be on Instagram anymore. There's a lot of people, of course, who, you know, move away from social media in general because it's nice to be a bit mysterious.
Right.
And people come and discover you on their own
You are. I just saw some phone in some very upbeat magazine here at the hotel where... for those who have everything and don't want to expose anything, it's just for texting and calls. You probably know about this
phone. It's the punked phone.
Yes.
It's a Swiss phone.
Yes.
We're going to find Michelle Comte on the end of it.
We probably will. That's brilliant. But I was very like, oh, this is nice. This is sort of like, you know, refreshing. Yeah. I mean, even my daughter's generation, I think they're all just tired of it. You know, they're tired of hooking up on whatever they hook up on. She's not, but I mean, but... you're 17, 18, 19, and you have to hook up with people on what is this? I mean, you're not meeting enough people at school? Apparently they're not.
Well, you anyway. Think, well, when she gets to Middlebury, you'd hope that she'll be remote enough that there's not much choice.
Well, that's true. She's got it. She's getting it together. Anyway, I think that people are really burning out on it. I know for myself, every time I have to post something, I'm like, you have to look up the name and the handle and the distance. I mean, you've wasted 15 minutes of your time. You know, but when I come to do a gig, you feel like you have to do it just because, you know, it does help sell tickets. Mm. But I don't know, does it? I don't know.
Are you pretty free in terms of your editorial beat agenda on the program to politically sort of do what you want, say what you want?
Oh, yeah, I can say and do it whatever I want. And yet I have purposefully stayed away from discussing our fake president because I don't want to give him
airtime.
Yeah, it's just like there's nothing to say. Unless I'm really fired up about something and then I'll do a screed, I'll get it out of my system and then go back to just talking about things that are just more fun and accessible, the word of the day. But what is there to say? We're in a real conundrum right now that we will work our way out of as we have with every other situation that's arisen politically from the beginning of time. It's a drama that unfolds every day, which he loves and which is why he's where he's at. And we just have to, like, just keep digging in and doing the work that you've got to do to, you know, to stay above the fray.
There's a liberty to this medium, being around two microphones. But just what everything has changed right now in media. There's been times when I thought you've moved over to Sirius doing this program that, and we've lost, I say we, I mean, in North America, the nightly newscast is not what it was. We don't have the icons that we used to have. The days of Tom, the Peter Jennings,
I'm going way back.
Oh yeah, you go way back. I'm sort of like the last batch. Dan Rather.
But Dan Rather's doing a show on Sirius.
Is it?
On my channel.
Okay.
On Andy Cohen's channel once a week.
But is there room for a switch up? Maybe there needs to be a new glamorous but serious nightly newscast again.
I just don't think that's ever going to happen with the disparity of cable and streaming and everything. I think that people don't watch television.
Oh, it doesn't have to be there. But I'm saying, actually, I wonder whether a Netflix could do a nightly newscast or someone else. Wouldn't be ABC or NBC anymore.
I just honestly don't think that certainly my daughter's generation would tune in for that. They get their news from so many disparate, outlets. Mm. They would never have the patience or the interest in sitting listening to one, person. I mean, I think
there's plenty of people over 40 though, who we shouldn't forget about people over 40.
But there's Rachel Maddow, there's Lawrence O'Donnell, who are all have their listeners, and I think that's the closest we're going to get.
The show. Tell us about the show. Why back on stage? Have you been doing sort of?
Oh, I've been doing it nonstop. I do a new show at Joe's Pub every year. I put together new material, and the show that I'm doing here at Ronnie Scott's is kind of an amalgam of last year's show, which was Sandra Monica Boulevard, and then this show, Sandemonium. It's really a hybrid of stories, little personal narratives, little journeys, all interwoven with music. Mitch Kaplan, who's sitting quietly in the corner, has been my musical director since 1985. I'm a loyal person. And that's just how I like it. I like having the continuity with at least one person in my life who knows the history, remembers the nuances, and we just keep, trucking along. I don't want to do anything that reinvents myself. Mm. I mean, I think reinvention is a day-to-day sort of phenomenon. You wake up every day and you've shifted a little bit emotionally, hopefully grown and evolved. But I think I'm suddenly, I'm a burlesque dancer. I'm an intellectual. Yeah, I'm a feminist. I'm a, I'm a stripper. I'm a whore. I mean, what the fuck am I? You get to the point where you don't even know who you are. I'm me. I mean, I've definitely I've got things, the rough edges are a little bit more smoothed out because when you have a kid and you're in a relationship, my girlfriend, Sarah, is a no-nonsense high wasp from St. Louis, Missouri, and she does not take to, over emotion or, hysteria well. So I've really had to tone it down because she goes, we don't need that right now. You got to deal with Sicily and this is not happening. So she's very hardcore, and which has been great for me. I'm totally emotionalist now. I'm gutted. I've lost all of my. No, I'm kidding. I say, we've been together for 18 years. Most of it spent in a light coma. No, she's wonderful, but she really has gotten me to be less histrionic, which was good because it's just too exhausting.
How important is that that live outlet, with your fan base sitting a couple of meters away from you in an intimate or big space in terms of your creative output, having a radio show, doing lots of other things, but getting in that room and being in the moment with people.
Well, it's really, you're flying by the seat of your pants, and I try not to over rehearse the show. So sometimes I just go in and I'm like, I'm uncertain, how things are going to go from A to B. But they find a natural rhythm, which is what I've always done. And I just don't like to beat the spontaneity out of a show. It's incredible. It's incredible because when you're on stage, and even if there's that little bit of a distance, it's a very hard to describe connection that you have with people because there's sort of a fourth wall, but there's not at all. And it's it's a controlled atmosphere, and yet anything could happen at any moment. And because of that, each night is like a snowflake or a leaf. Everyone has its own imprint, and you can never recreate it night to night. That night that you saw that show was, you'll never see it again. It might be the same material, but the emotion or the people together brought an energy that you can't recreate.
mean, Sandemonium sounds like a really, really good sub-brand. So how long is this going to run for?
You know, my shows are always sort of an evolution, you know, year to year. I mean, it's like one takes off where the other one left off.
But how much are you going to tour this one, do you think?
Well, James, who's booking my shows in the corner, I better get busy because I need to make some money.
Well, you got to get to Arkansas for sure.
I got to get to Arkansas. Yeah, absolutely. I try to do two or three dates every month. And then things just happen. You know what I mean? Suddenly, you know, somebody will want you to come somewhere and then one thing leads to the other. But I don't do like tours. I don't like take off like a month or two and go out on the road. I couldn't take it. I couldn't take going from place to place night after night. So a week at the most is all I can take. Physically and emotionally, and then I got to get back home.
And how's it feel being on this side of the Atlantic?
Always the best. I love it here. I love London. I love being in Europe. It just takes you away from the day to day. The sense of continuity and history when you're traveling is always palpable. And even though, you know, people have come and gone and, you know, royalty has come and gone, there's just something about the connection to the past that makes you just sort of sink into it in a way that, you know, it just doesn't feel like that in America. I mean, maybe the country itself, the physicality of the country has a certain awe-inspiring quality, but certainly not the people.
Looking back, I mean, it's amazing to say a quarter century, looking at high points, low points, but hopefully high points in sort of popular culture. Is there a certain little epoch that you're sort of nostalgic for? You thought this was an incredible moment from media, fashion, theater, you know, just the pop culture sort of channel in general, you thought that was a great moment. And if we could take a little bit of that back again, or at least sprinkle a bit of it around, not by being in a better place, but maybe just some things that you're nostalgic for.
Well, I mean, you know, having spanned many decades and yet still feeling very young, you know, growing up in Flint, Michigan in the 60s until we moved to Arizona, when, you know, I remember, of course, the day that Kennedy was assassinated. I mean, I remember the feeling of that time and the music and, you know, Motown and the Supremes and everything that came out of that. And then segueing into our move to Arizona when I was 10 and just the whole, you know, 60s revolution. My brothers were, you know, 4, 6, 8 years older than myself. You know, we're all part of that time and the music and the energy and Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther. I mean, all that stuff. I mean, to have actually been young and been witness to it, really, you know, it's kind of phenomenal because, you know, of course, people study it and they know about it and you hear about it. But to have been there and seen it through the eyes of my brothers and my parents and myself, but still being very young. And then, of course, the 70s, which was, you know, a very, like, in terms of feminism and Mary Tyler Moore and Gloria Steinem and Ms. Magazine, you know, it was sort of in lockstep to what I was feeling, listening to Joni Mitchell and Carole King and all the great singers of the time, and then segueing right out of that into my move to L.A. in 74. And all the great films that came out of the 70s. I just watched Shampoo again on the plane the other day. And I forgot the whole political backdrop to that film. And also just addressing the sort of disposable nature of relationships and women and the need to have money, which has never, you know, really left our culture. Power, powerful men. God, it's just like there's just been so many great eras. And then once I kind of hit my stride post King of Comedy and started, you know, doing my one-woman shows and being in New York and just the energy of the club scene and the artists and all the great people that came out of the 80s and then the AIDS situation that decimated a whole culture and generation. So up until the AIDS crisis, to me, it was just like the most exciting time. And then it was a devastating time, and things really shifted after that, I think, in terms of the gay culture and the sort of openness and freedom that was such a great reflection of growing up in that era.
And what I'm getting at is, some days I don't know if we're in a dark time, because I just came back from, you know, from Journey of Life, but was in Bangkok earlier in the week. And, you know, you get to Asia and there's an energy and there's an excitement and there's a positive naivete about the world. And,
oh, I know.
And which is so invigorating. And then, you know, we see that in the West, you know, there are many, you know, many dark clouds mm-hmm. that we have lived through. But do you think, just as we sort of look back over the last quarter century, and I think taking that AIDS moment, then what happened with gay culture after, the blossoming, the flourishing, the emancipation, everything that came right after was amazing to witness. And can we only hope that that happens 3 or 4 years out from now? And not that it's just even tied to a presidency either.
Right. There's always that shift that start, you can feel it, you can sense it coming. I don't know if I feel it right now. The only shift I'm feeling is, you know, the whole Florida gun situation and all these kids. I'm totally blown away. Not a good term to use, but by their courage and intelligence.
And it's amazing that hasn't taken hold before. And it's
well, I guess, you know what? It's just, I mean,
everything has its moment.
This school must have like really encouraged, you know, independent thinking, because what I've seen come out of there are kids that are just absolutely articulate and wonderful and seemingly like not traumatized in that sort of a maudlin American fashion that seems to go on and on and on, where everybody just falls apart and falls into heaps and then just goes back to their lives. Mm. They seem like they're going to go the distance to try to make this happen.
No, we hope they do. And then it's again, it becomes so depressing, though, because suddenly you have sort of two people on social media on Capitol Hill saying that this is, you know, they're all being stirred up, you know, in the background by a couple of spin doctors, you think, could be, but can we just actually run with the story
as
it is, please?
Guess what? Good. Churn it up. Make it happen. Make these kids have enough courage and protection that they can go and express what they were feeling in the middle of it. I mean, they had the sensibility to like start filming it. You know, they knew what was happening, and they knew this was a moment. So I have a lot of faith in the next generation to help move this along. For myself personally, I always feel a sense of excitement and you know, wonder at the world and what I get to do. So I don't know. I've never become a cynic or I try not to be. You know, I try not to go with that sort of cheap approach to being a person or my work.
Do you feel, and this is just before we go, that does office, political office, or is it more interesting to agitate from the, well, not even just the edges, I mean, you know, sometimes close to the center as well, but have you ever sort of thought, God, you know what, I'm just going to maybe toss my hat in the ring? You'd want to be more active.
Oh, God, no. I would never. I don't have the patience or the stamina to get up every day. I mean, when I look at Hillary Clinton, and in spite of all her foibles and things that people can't get ready for her, you know, I mean, she was able to get up every day and go into the trenches. There's no way. I mean, I like to eat a certain way. I've got to go to the bathroom at a certain time. Everything has to be in order for me. I mean, my digestive system couldn't take it. Being Jewish, you know, we need to have our private time.
On that note, Sandra, we'll leave you just your private time. Because if I look at the clock, it's that time of the morning on the East Coast. Really good to see you, and looking forward to seeing the show.
Thank you. It's great to see you, Tyler. It's always a pleasure. And I'm always in awe that you managed to, like, keep things fresh and churning and interesting culturally. It's important, and you're like one of the forerunners in that whole interesting world.
Thank you. The Big Interview is produced by Guy Lutz and edited by Cassie Galpin. I'm Tyler Brulé. Goodbye.